From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Oscar-winning film director Costa Gavras makes movies about intolerance. His films Z, Missing, Betrayed, and his latest The Music Box have examined issues like fascism and racism. A talk with Costa Gavras on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we meet a pair of filmmakers in line for several Oscars this year. Noel Pearson and Jim Sheridan's movie My Left Foot is up for Best Picture and Best Director. Not bad for their first movie. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new John Coltrane reissue. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a pair of new sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. East Germany's Social Democratic Party, a runner-up in yesterday's elections, has refused to join in a coalition with the conservatives who won. The Social Democrats and a small liberal party were invited to join in a broad government coalition by Christian Democratic leader Lothar de Maizière, the head of the largest group in the Alliance for Germany. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl cautioned against allowing the unification process to become too hectic, though he plans to keep up the momentum. Deirdre Berger reports.
After the elections in East Germany yesterday, the conservative parties have an excellent chance of winning the first united German elections, according to West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. But he said he did not expect such elections to take place this year. Kohl said Bonn is prepared to start working on an economic and currency union as soon as the East German government takes office. Elmar Pierrot, who the conservatives in East Germany have nominated for economic minister, said he expects the union to take effect by July 1st. The opposition Social Democrats in Bonn today announced that, as expected, Oscar Lafontaine will be their candidate for chancellor in December elections. Lafontaine said the elections in East Germany were influenced by unrealistic economic promises of Chancellor Kohl, and Lafontaine intends to hold Kohl to his word. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
The Soviet Union has said that it respects the will of the East German electorate, but has said again that a united Germany cannot be part of NATO. The Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov also warned that unification shouldn't happen too quickly. The BBC's Mark Leite reports from Moscow.
Mr. Gerasimov was careful to avoid attacking the conservative Alliance for Germany, but he forcefully repeated the Soviet line on German unification, which contradicts many of the stated views of the conservatives. He attacked any rush to unification, saying it must go stage by stage, its pace dictated by and synchronized with the development of new European-wide cooperative and security structures. A unified Germany cannot be a member of NATO, he said. That would break the basis of European security. He also warned there was still a danger of a rebirth of fascism in Germany and called for it to guarantee its present borders and sign a final peace treaty with the victors of World War II. There's no doubt within the Soviet leadership there's a genuine concern about a unified Germany, and many believe this internal pressure lies behind some of Mr. Gorbachev's tougher comments on unification.
The BBC's Mark Leite reporting from Moscow. On Wall Street today, a flurry of buying in the closing minutes pulled the market back from a steep decline. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down almost 23 points at one time, but late activity brought it up by more than 14 points at the end of trading. The Dow closed at 2,755.63. This is NPR News. At least 10 people have lost their lives in flooding across southern Alabama, and nearly 4,000 people have been evacuated from their homes. National Guard soldiers stood guard to prevent looting in the town of Elba, evacuated when an earthen levee broke after being pounded by 16 inches of rain in 2 days. Water stood at the window level of many houses, leaving residents with no immediate hope of returning home. The high water also flushed out snakes, with many reported swimming through the flooded neighborhoods. The National Weather Service says that many rivers in southern Alabama and Georgia probably won't crest until tomorrow. Baseball fans may be enjoying a collective sigh of relief at the end of the spring training lockout, but that won't ease the economic pain in the spring training centers of Arizona and Florida. Spring training baseball would normally put some $145 million into Arizona's economy. The lockout meant hard times for tourism and a lot of local charities. Doug Ramsey of member station KJZZ reports.
The opening of spring training comes too late for many of Arizona's winter visitors. They'll be heading home by the time games start in a week. Motels are normally booked solid in March, but vacancy rates of more than 30% are common due to cancellations. Hardest hit are the civic organizations sponsoring the ball clubs. Many have taken out long-term loans to finance stadium improvements. With only 2 weeks of games this year, there won't be nearly enough income from ticket sales to cover the payments. At several Cactus League ballparks, concession sales are handled by youth groups. Not only have the youngsters lost sales, but they also face bills for the merchandise they bought and cannot return. For spring training in Arizona, the lockout settlement is too little, too late. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Ramsey in Phoenix.
The White House says former Yale first baseman George Bush is looking for a chance to throw out a first pitch in the 1990 season. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Costa Gavras, the Greek emigre film director. He's best known for his political thrillers. His 1969 film, Z, won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Set in Greece, it starred Yves Montand as a liberal politician assassinated by right-wing military officers. State of Siege also starred Montand. He played a U.S. CIA officer kidnapped and murdered by a radical guerrilla group in Uruguay. Both Z and State of Siege were made in France, where Costa Gavras has lived since the 1950s. Costa Gavras has also made several American films. Missing starred Jack Lemmon as a father who goes to a Latin American country in search of his son who has disappeared during a military coup. In the movie Betrayed, Deborah Winger played an FBI officer who falls in love with the white supremacist she's investigating. Costa Gavras' latest film is The Music Box. Jessica Lange is up for an Academy Award for her portrayal of a lawyer defending her father, a Hungarian immigrant on trial for Nazi war crimes. I spoke to Costa Gavras just before The Music Box was released. You know, until the end of the film, we don't know if the father's guilty or not, so we don't know how to feel toward him. I asked Costa Gavras if he wanted to play with that uncertainty in the film.
Absolutely. It's essential to not know about what the end is, and I beg the viewers who have seen the movie to not tell their friends what the end is. It's like telling them the end of a tennis game, who is the winner. You lose some of the pleasure to discover, like she discovered your father, like Jessica Lange, the character in the movie, discovers her father. That was really done in purpose from the very, very beginning.
Now, are you worried about that at all? I think it's actually really hard to keep the ending of a movie quiet.
I know, but, you know, I remember when I was younger, the Hitchcock movies, nobody used to say the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the thrillers, generally, it's better to not know the end.
I remember when State of Siege was made, there were a couple of interviews with you in which you mentioned that you wanted to cast Yves Montand in the role of the American CIA agent who's held captive because you were afraid that an American actor would be a little over the top in their performance and that they'd make the CIA agent too unlikable. Now that you've been working more with American actors in your recent movies, do you still feel that way?
No, probably had by that the time a very, let's say, one-way position. But if few actors I saw for that, I won't name them, especially one of them, would like to push the story in that direction. And he said he's a bad guy, we have to have him bad all the way down. I don't believe bad guys are bad guys all the way down. I think bad guys are great with their families, with their kids. We are very much used in the movies to see bad guys being really awful bad and having even their dogs being bad. I think the life is all different. And with Montand, we have so much collaboration. And when I told him he's someone who's doing bad things, but he's a good guy for his family. He's a good guy for even for his country because he follows a kind of policy the government or some people in the government have established, and he's executing it. And he accepted without any fear or any tentative to change it.
Well, this whole idea that bad guys aren't bad all the way through, that they're often really nice with their families, that has so much to do with your last two movies. It's one of the subjects that's raised in The Music Box, but also in Betrayed.
Sort of. You know, I remember seeing a movie on Hitler in his mountain house with the children and with his dog, and the movie was made in color, which was very unusual at the time. And Hitler looked so great person. and he laughs with his friends around of him. He's very good with the children. So I insist strongly and heavily, bad guys are not bad all the way down to everybody.
Now, how does that influence your casting? Like, in some kinds of movies, the bad guys have to be physically unattractive. Do you know what I mean? So you could tell
absolutely,
the good guy from the bad
absolutely.
Guy?
Absolutely. When they cast, generally, we used to look like for guys like Jack Palance or, you know. That
right, guy, right, yeah. Exactly.
Which is also very fake.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a whole period in the movies in which we overdo it with in that direction. I mean, the bad guys were, as I was saying before, really bad. They have a bad face, they have bad hands, everything was ugly, and like if the appearance could change, could be as ugly as the soul or the brain. I think those things are not going together. With that idea in the head, we should say all the handsome guys and girls are beautiful people.
Has it been difficult for you to start directing American movies? Because of any cultural differences, also because of the language. I don't know how quickly you felt acclimated to directing in English and working with the kind of English colloquialisms that end up in movies.
That's not really the problem. The problem is to know that country, to have the time to stay more and travel around and see the people and speak with the people. I think the language and the colloquialisms and also the playing the language by the actors and understanding if it's a good or bad, it's not really a problem. I think for the acting, for me, it's a kind of music. If the music sounds okay, it's good. If it doesn't sound, it's like in a partition with notes. The problem for me is to stay in the country. So I did so since now 10 years. I spent a lot of time. I went around. I traveled. I saw a lot of people. So I have the feeling I know a little bit better than before, because in the early 70s, they asked me several times to make movies here, and I just refused because I didn't know the country.
So what have you done to try to get more of a grasp of American culture?
Oh, to go deeper to the country. For example, when I did Betrayed, mm-hmm. I went around the country. I traveled in several states. I went to Nebraska, to Idaho, Montana, and I asked to visit farms. I asked to speak with farmers, to see people from closer. And I have another way also of doing it. I asked to my assistants to find television, local televisions and the national televisions, shows, tapes, with interviews and on the people. And all those elements permit me to have a kind of image. I'm not saying this is the right image. This is the exactly, I have the perfect image. But this is a little bit my opinion on what I'm seeing and my point of view. And for every director, he has a point of view and he expresses his own point of view. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. Film director Costa Gavras is my guest. His new movie is called The Music Box, and it stars Jessica Lange. I think several of your movies have been, in a way, about how fascism is manifested in different cultures. Can I ask what your first exposure to fascism was? Was it during World War II?
I prefer to speak about intolerance in my movies.
Oh, okay, as opposed to a more political?
It's supposed to be more precise, probably, or more vague, because fascism, it refers to a special regime like the Hitler's regime or the extreme right wing. I think sometimes the extreme left also. It has also his intolerance,
mm-hmm.
and I did some movies on that too. So, yes, I was exposed in intolerance, and I sometimes we all are exposed in intolerance every day around of us.
But what was the first manifestation of political intolerance that you experienced?
Oh, it was when I was in Greece during the civil war after the First World War, and the intolerance was everywhere, in every corner, in the schools. For example, I couldn't go to the university because my father was considered as being a leftist because he had fought against the Germans. And I couldn't go to the university. I had to go to France. I mean, it was one of the small elements of intolerance. And by the time you couldn't live every day intolerance, only everyday life.
Now your father was a Russian immigrant who moved.
My family is coming from Russia. My father is there in Greece for years now, for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought with the left-wing people against Germans during the German occupation. And all those guys after the liberation were considered as being communists. So they have been jailed, they lost their jobs, and they have, for years, they have a lot of problems. The kids couldn't go to the schools, to the university, essentially, because their fathers have been considered as communists.
Was there any other direct effects that your father's status as a political outcast had on you when you were growing up?
Oh, I don't have really personal memories, but it was everywhere. There was no any free speech. There was no any free newspapers. There was no... the police were everywhere. You have to have in your house, for example, a list with the people who are sleeping in the house. And if a cousin or a friend was coming to spend the evening with you, you have to go to the police because we didn't have telephone to call them. We have to go to the police and to tell them that my cousin is coming today to sleep at home. If you didn't do it, you go to the jail next day.
Was it because you weren't allowed to go to a university in Greece that you decided to go to France and to attend the Sorbonne?
No, I couldn't go because my father's passed. I couldn't go to the university in Greece, so I decided to go to France.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were a poor family, I have to work also just to be able to. But fortunately, the French universities are all free. There's a lot of help. There used to be, and still is, help for the students. There's dormitories in... not very expensive, their restaurants, so forth. So, and I was able to make studies without needing a lot of money.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is film director Costa Gavras. His political thrillers include Z, State of Siege, Missing, Hannah Kay, and Betrayed. His new film, The Music Box, stars Jessica Lange as a lawyer whose father, a Hungarian immigrant, is accused of Nazi war crimes. She defends him during his trial. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director Costa Gavras is my guest. His latest film is The Music Box. Jessica Lange has been nominated for an Academy Award for her starring role. You studied filmmaking in France.
That's right.
And I think, you know, early on in your film career, you started to make political movies, movies with a political narrative theme. Were you ever politically active yourself? Were you ever a student activist or identified with any movement?
Not really, but let me tell you first that I don't consider my movies... I think all the movies are political movies. So people are characterized my movies only being political. I think every movie has a political contain. Every movie carries the philosophy and the political feelings of the persons who are doing it, the director, the writer, or both of them, and so forth. So my to ask directly to your question, my past... No, I never was affiliated to a party or to a political movement. I took positions, as most of the students did at the time, for example, against the war of Algeria, which de Gaulle was doing at the beginning. And then when de Gaulle did some good things, I was for de Gaulle. So essentially always try not to just be member of an ideology of a party, but to try to judge the governments or the parties from what they were doing. I think today the person I if you ask me for whom I vote in France, I vote for Mitterrand. I think it's the best candidate we have, and it's the best president we have.
Mm-hmm.
We could have.
You started studying filmmaking in France at, I guess, about the time of the French New Wave. Now the style of the French New Wave was really influenced by American genre films, gangster movies, westerns. Were you interested in pursuing that sensibility at all when you were starting off as a young filmmaker?
Yeah, the New Wave is probably larger than that. The New Wave is a kind of revolution in the French cinema, which was after the war without any major change. So young people decided to get rid of the old directors who were doing the movies in a very traditional way with big crews, with big cameras and so forth. At the same time, they have the possibility to use smaller cameras and very fast stock, which they could shoot outside without so much light. So the techniques helped that new movement to do new movies. And those movies was much less expensive than the other ones. And every young man was enough to have a good story and a couple of actors accepting to play in this story, and they were doing the movies. So it was really a fundamental change for the French and the European cinema. I get into the movies. I was by then assistant to director. And I started doing my first movie just at the very end of the movement, when the movement somehow was, let's say, exhausted and have proved all they have, it had to prove. And probably some of the new wave directors started doing the movies in a traditional way by the time.
Mm-hmm. The first movie that you made that, I think the first movie that you made that actually got shown in America at many movie houses was Z.
No, my first movie was Sleeping Car Murder.
But was that shown in the States?
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Z was quite the third movie. My first movie was Sleeping Car Murders, and it was really very, very well received. It was also put in a list among the 10 best of the year.
I see, okay. A movie like Z was very unusual in that it was a political film, it was a foreign film, and it was also a box office hit. And this was during a period when a lot of people wouldn't even go to see foreign movies because they didn't want to read subtitles in America. Did you have any ideas of why your film ended up being as successful as it did? Because I think it really went against the grain in terms of what was popular at the time, what was selling at the time.
This is a very tough question. I really don't know. It was a big surprise to us because we spent with my producer and more than 1 year trying to find the money to make the movie, and everybody was refusing. Most of the American companies based in Paris refused to make the movie. And so we insisted, we did all of us, actors and myself, the movie without being paid. And we were so surprised to see the success of the movie. And I was surprised to see the movie being shown in small towns in the United States with subtitles and having a big success. So this is a mystery. This is a mystery why. Probably it's linked to the period, to the theme, I don't know. Really, I don't know. Jean Cocteau, you probably know who he was. It's French poet. He used to say, there is rules for the success of the movies, but we don't know them.
That seems very accurate. Were there ever any reprisals against your family in Greece after Z came out?
No, I think they weren't home. They sent some people in home, and they were very aggressive, and I had a very strong mother. So she threw them out very aggressively and physically, and she said, if you need them, go to have them. He's in Paris. Here, you don't have anything to do. And they were old people, so they didn't really touch them. They didn't insist.
Now, what was the government like in Greece when Z came out?
Oh, God, it was the militaries, very aggressive. And I learned much later that we were 3 or 4 people to be on a blacklist to be assassinated or something like this. I don't know if it's truth or not, but I was told that because of Z and some other people, because of these songs and other people's, before the statements they were making against them.
And you were never concerned? I mean, let me put it this way. You never thought twice about making the movie out of fear that you or someone in your family would be hurt?
No, I told my family what I was making, so the father said, okay, go and do it. That's your story. We are here. We see how we face it if they will be against us. And since the movie became a big success, they couldn't touch them, of course.
Did you ever want to return to Greece and live there, make movies there?
No, because I left very young, and probably I will return to making movies, but not stay there all my time. I like to go there to see friends, to see my family, and have some vacations. It's a great place for that. But I'm so much taken with France, and my family's French now.
Mm-hmm. Film director Costa Gavras is my guest, and his new movie is called The Music Box. Have you run into much censorship in different countries, censorship of your movies?
Oh, yes. I think half of the countries, in half of the countries in the world, my movies weren't shown. Of course, when the regime's changing, my movies are shown. And let's say, for example, in the Eastern countries, my movies weren't shown, even Z. So I hope now they will be shown.
Mm-hmm. Your mother was Greek Orthodox and very religious. I was wondering if you were religious when you were growing up and if you are now.
Yes, I was. But very young, I started thinking, and I had a lot of disappointments. And I have a really negative relationship and discussion with God, and when he was accepting to be done, so I stay away. I'm away. I don't believe anymore. I'm agnostic.
Ah, okay.
And I don't like the way God is used either by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. You think a lot of people are self-serving in their use of their religion?
Yeah, saying faith things. It's insane.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what your next movie will be?
Really not. Really not.
There's been periods during your career when you've gone around 4 years without making a movie. Was that out of... Was that because you didn't want to, or because you couldn't find a script that you liked, or was it hard getting work then?
No, it's essentially because I didn't have the script I liked. A director, myself, I have four ideas and directions in my head, and I would like to find stories to speak about those directions and ideas. And if I don't find them, I won't do a movie, which is in a completely different way. And if I don't feel concerned, humanly and let's say historically, as you say, politically also, of course. Ideologically, I would say, if not philosophically.
Do you get sent a lot of screenplays that people assume will be right up your alley that you, in fact, don't like?
I receive a lot of scripts. After Z, I received hundreds of scripts on political assassinations. And then after Betrayed, after Missing, I received a lot of scripts on missing people and that kind of stories. And then I think people think, as I'm doing one story, I am ready to do the same story in different aspects. I'm trying to do different every time, which is not so easy. And sometimes the reason for what I can stay 2 or 3 years without doing anything.
Film director Costa Gavras. His latest movie is The Music Box. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, Robert Caro talks with us about the second volume in his biography of Lyndon Johnson. This volume shows Johnson buying and stealing votes to get to the Senate. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's John Coltrane, recorded at Birdland in 1963. It's from an album that's just been reissued. And coming up, jazz critic Evan Whitehead tells us about what he calls his favorite Coltrane record. Also, we meet film producer Noel Pearson and film director Jim Sheridan. Together, they made My Left Foot, the story of Christy Brown, who painted and wrote with the one part of his body he could control, his left foot. The movie is up for Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new sitcoms. One casts Frank Zappa's kids as normal people. The other stars Valerie Bertinelli as a wisecracking private eye. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The head of East Germany's Christian Democratic Party outlined twin aims today: quick unity with West Germany and destruction of the rest of the Berlin Wall. The Christian Democrats were the big winners in yesterday's elections, but since they are short of a majority in parliament, they are working to form a coalition. NPR's Deborah Amos has more from West Berlin.
The man set to be the prime minister of East Germany held his first news conference today following his election victory. Lothar de Maizière said he was offering the second largest party in the elections, the Social Democrats, a chance for a broad coalition. The offer was turned down this afternoon. It's likely that the Christian Democrats can find other parties to make a majority in the 400-member parliament. Today's offer to the Social Democrats was seen as a recognition that the road to unity with West Germany is likely to be a bumpy one, and a broad coalition more likely to absorb the shocks. The election results are to be officially confirmed on Friday. Then the Communist Party, in charge of the country as part of a caretaker government, will hand over power to the ruling coalition. In West Berlin, this is Deborah Amos.
The White House said today the victory of East German conservatives in Sunday's elections gives strength to the idea of keeping a united Germany in NATO. Press Secretary Marlene Fitzwater said the elections were a victory not only for the people of East Germany, but for all Germans and all who support democratic values. But Soviet officials say to allow a united Germany in NATO would upset the balance of power. The Soviet government warned today that it will block efforts by Lithuania to take over national industries, a new sign of Kremlin pressure against its runaway republics. Lithuania's non-communist legislature declared itself independent 8 days ago, a move that Moscow has denounced as illegal and invalid. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
So far, the independence war is one of words and resolutions. Today, the Lithuanian government rejected Kremlin criticism, saying the Soviet government has no legal standing to stop the republic's actions. The Kremlin sent a swift reply, warning it will take steps to prevent the new leadership from taking over Soviet-built industries, ports, and other facilities. The Kremlin didn't spell out specific retaliation measures if Lithuania doesn't comply. But according to residents of Vilnius, the Lithuanian capital, Moscow's already stepped up psychological pressure, blocking international phone calls out of Lithuania and dropping anti-independence leaflets from military helicopters circling the city. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 14 points to close at 2,755.63 on volume of 142 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Coltrane remains one of the most influential and widely admired musicians in modern jazz. He recorded well over 50 albums as a leader in the decade before his death in 1967. His career also spans stints in the bands of Johnny Hodges, Miles Davis, and Thelonious Monk. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says so many Coltrane records are in print, it's hard for the novice to decide where to begin.
One of the occupational hazards of being a critic, aside from the fact that a lot of people think we're all jerks, is that folks are always asking me what my favorite albums are. What's your favorite album of the 80s? Or what's your favorite record of all time? Questions like that leave me tongue-tied because there are too many good ones to choose from. The answers keep changing from day to day. But for some reason, I've always had a favorite John Coltrane record. That's The Promise from Coltrane Live at Birdland, which has just been reissued on Impulse. It was recorded at that New York club and in the studio in the fall of 1963. Everything comes together on this record. The band is Coltrane's so-called classic quartet, with McCoy Tyner on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums. At the time, Coltrane was obsessed with playing simple structures with maximum freedom. On Live at Birdland, he plays the ballads on tenor saxophone, his original instrument. But the melodies he plays on soprano sax are as catchy and repetitive as children's songs. That's Coltrane's tune, Afro Blue. By 1963, John Coltrane had been playing soprano sax for 3 years. His tightrope control at this point is miles beyond earlier efforts, like his hit version of My Favorite Things. This music shows how an ideal rhythm section can liberate a soloist. Coltrane was an instinctively harmonic improviser. He always shaped his improvisations to the chords his pianist played. McCoy Tyner's genius was that he played chords so wide open and ambiguous, almost anything would fit over the top. In a similar way, the drumming of Elvin Jones implies several rhythms at the same time, so Coltrane can go in whatever direction he wants. Jimmy Garrison anchors everyone else. While the rest of the band spins around him, he walks his bass through the center of the storm. The quartet was one of the most perfect groups in jazz history, and it never had a stronger set of tunes to play than on Live at Birdland. Because the songs are so easy to remember, you can follow the melody no matter how radically Coltrane bends it out of shape. Here's Coltrane on his composition named Your Lady. The other thing that comes through there is Coltrane's optimistic spirit. His lines really soar. So all of that is why Live at Birdland is my favorite Coltrane. Actually, now that I think about it, I have two favorite Coltrane records. The other is Coltrane Plays the Blues, which Atlantic reissued last year. Oh, and there's also the album John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman, where the quartet plays ballads and Hartman sings in his incredibly romantic baritone. I like that a lot, too. But I'll still give Live at Birdland the edge. It captures a classic band at its absolute peak, doing exactly what it does best.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. The film My Left Foot has been nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It's the story of Irish writer Christy Brown, who was paralyzed from cerebral palsy. He painted and wrote with the only part of his body he could control, his left foot. Daniel Day-Lewis stars as Christy Brown. It's the first film for producer Noel Pearson and director Jim Sheridan, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Pearson was a friend of Christy Brown's and is the director of Dublin's Abbey Theatre. Sheridan also came from a theater background. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Noel Pearson and Jim Sheridan about their low-budget debut that has won the acclaim of critics and audiences. In this scene, Brown, already a celebrated writer, is the guest of honor at a society fundraiser. When it's time for him to make his entrance, he causes a scene trying to get a date with the nurse that has attended him during the evening.
What are you afraid of?
I'm not afraid of anything. You imagine that people are afraid of you. I'm not afraid of you, okay?
You're afraid of yourself.
Oh, come on. Look, just... You're afraid of me. We can't talk about this now. Look, I'm going.
Why can't we talk now? Now's a good enough time for me.
I'll see you again sometime.
Okay. I heard that before, Mary. Why did that with some f***ing time? Mary, Dane! Stane!
Noel, you knew Christy Brown and his family. Did you have any concerns about presenting him in too unflattering of a way?
No, not at all. I mean, if Christy Brown was alive today, you know, and this film was anything but what it is now, he would give me a really hard time, you know. He tried desperately all the time not to be sentimental and not to be mushy, and that's the way he was, and I think that the film reflects very much the spirit of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the integrity of the film is unquestionable, because that's the way Christy Brown was, you know.
Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Christy Brown, he gave such a great performance, and he was so able to bring out kind of Christy's inner life with very little dialogue. And I was wondering if, as you went along filming, if you found yourself changing some of your original ideas because of his capability.
No. We didn't change anything as we went along. We did the script, I'd say, 99% what we set out to do. And I think the areas that we only toned down Christy in was in his drinking and, you know, areas that would push him towards a stereotypical character, you know, because he was quite wild.
I guess I was thinking maybe you would have been able to kind of take out some of the dialogue or take out some of the explanations because he was so able to express things just through his physical performance.
Yeah, I think that happened more in the editing. And Daniel's capabilities are both... I think he is extraordinary with his eyes, but... He's also extraordinary with his voice, the voice that he used for Christy, because it's like a kind of animal presence, you know.
Daniel had a 6 to 8 weeks preparation period where he went to a clinic every day and learned how to paint with his left foot. I mean, all those paintings he did of himself, you know, with his left foot. And during the learning process, we knew there was going to be absolutely no difficulty with him portraying it, so there was no compromise, because very early on... We knew his performance was going to be astonishing.
How did you direct Daniel Day-Lewis to do that? He's so contorted and he's writhing around all the time and he has these very emotional facial expressions. As the director, Jim, what did you tell him?
Not much. The only kind of thing, we had a few discussions before we started, you know, and I had a tape of Christy that Daniel saw, you know, of the actual Christy Brown.
You see, in the preparation, Daniel spent a fair bit of time with the Browns, the brothers and sisters. So we kind of captured the spirit of the whole thing before he went on the set at all.
Yeah, and I try to not set up a thing like a director thing, you know, like a school by system, you know, where you're telling people what to do. I just don't believe in that at all. I think basically 99% of acting is in the casting. If somebody's cast right in a film, they've a great chance. If they're not cast right, they've no chance. And then, you know, you can cast somebody like Daniel, who you're casting against type, and it's so far away from the image of Daniel Day-Lewis that you know deep down it's right.
I read that while you were filming it, he stayed in character during the entire 6 weeks, and you were working on a relatively small budget. Did you have to hire extra people to carry him around and feed him and dress him?
No, the family did that. The actual brothers and the actors, you know, the actors in the film who played his brothers and his sisters, they did it. They, you know, he lived, the family thing was kept right on through the dinner breaks and the lunch breaks.
Well, the fact that he just wouldn't get out of his wheelchair and wouldn't walk and move, did that slow down production in any way?
Yeah.
A little, but not really, no.
It didn't, it slowed the mechanical thing of him getting to the set and stuff like that, but it almost had the opposite effect in another way in that, you know, you never had to do a shot twice. In other words, nobody ever had to, Daniel never had to get into character, we never had to wait in any of that. So in the setting one off against the other, I'd say we saved time. It's just like everything else in life. If, you know, if somebody's handicapped and you make it a problem, it becomes a problem. If you pay attention to it, it becomes something else. You know, just like somebody who can't move any muscles except their foot, and suddenly they put so much effort into this that they become a genius or a great writer, and nobody else in the family does. In fact, you know, the rest of the family are so far away from writing and stuff that you wonder how Christy ever did it, you know. I mean, he's from a working class, very poor background. It's a really astonishing story.
Mm-hmm. I heard that Daniel Day-Lewis's performance took quite a toll on his body.
When he twisted at the end of the screen and filming, he had a couple of vertebrae out, but strangely enough, they were put back together by one of the stuntmen the last day. They just pushed him back in. But he did have a physiotherapist, which he had to go to twice, three times a week. It did take a toll on his body. But that's the way he wanted it, and he wouldn't have had it any other way.
Hmm. Since in the film, since the main character is so physically confined and can't really speak clearly, was it tricky to write a film that had really compelling action and dialogue?
Difficult, I suppose. Depends on your definition of action, you know. But, like, I suppose the fact that he couldn't speak freed us from the stereotype of the voluble, romantic Irishman and forced, as you say, you know, the communication to happen through the eyes and willpower. And that's always very dramatic and cinematic.
Do you think that you cheated at all on the accuracy in order to expedite the plot? Like, did Christy in the movie take any actions that the real Christy probably couldn't have actually done, or did he speak more clearly towards the end of the film than Christy Brown actually spoke?
Hard to know.
I think at the end he did speak slightly more clearly than Christy Brown did. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he did, yeah.
Jim, you'd never directed a film before, so how did you know what to do?
He didn't. It was a fluke.
I just... how did I know what to do? I don't know. I just imagined the frame and looked through the camera and said, okay, do that, do that, do that. And just kept saying, do it that way. And... sure, there's no mystique to it, you know. It's just not compromising, and I suppose.
Do you think that you had some ideas that veteran filmmakers might have thought were really unreasonable, but you didn't realize they were unreasonable, and then you were able to pull them off?
Absolutely. The great danger is, as it is in the theatre, because when I started in the theatre, I knew nothing about it either. It's then when you get to acquire the little knowledge, that's when you make terrible mistakes, you know?
Yeah, you have to keep making it with the eyes of an innocent, I think. You know, child. It's hard to stay like that when you know a little bit.
The Academy Awards ceremony is on March 26th, and I assume that you're both planning to be there. Is that correct?
Yeah,
we are.
So how do you prepare for something like that? Do you actually go ahead and plan a speech just in
Not
case?
Not at all.
Shave.
Wash your hair for the first time in that month. Get a new suit. Get the buttons put back on your shirt, you know. And
have a few drinks.
Have a few drinks and pray a lot.
Take a sleeping tablet the night before.
No.
No?
We never do that. Good pint of Guinness is better than any sleeping tablet. But it's just...
We won't be asleep at the Academy Awards.
It's a funny process. We've just come in from Los Angeles, where we've been there for 2.5 weeks, and we've got to go back next week. And it's all the hype and the... Whew, it's kind of a different planet from where we come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not a bad place either.
Noel Pearson, the producer of My Left Foot, he and the director of the film, Jim Sheridan, spoke with Fresh Air's Amy Sallet. My Left Foot has been nominated for 5 Academy Awards. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, do you have a report from your recent trip to the Soviet Union?
Yes, I do. Today we'll be hearing about our visit to the city of Donetsk. That's the Russian pronunciation. The Ukrainians there call it Donetsk. And it's a famous Soviet mining town where there were strikes last summer, you may recall. And we went down into the coal mines, visited with some of the people who work there, and then with members of the strike committee to ask them whether things are any better now than they were last summer. And as we heard in much of the Soviet Union, people are very excited about the political freedoms they enjoy, but don't see any real material improvements in their lives.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. All of the major TV networks are currently trying out a lot of new shows. Those that do well may end up in the big fall season lineup. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of 2 new sitcoms premiering this Wednesday night on CBS.
CBS is in such bad shape that when it comes up with a new show that isn't a total failure, it's a big surprise. Well, surprise. One of the network's new sitcoms actually has potential. Both of these shows are star vehicles for young stars. Normal Life, which isn't the good one, stars Dweezil and Moon Unit Zappa, 2 of Frank Zappa's kids. In real life, Dweezil, who's the guy, is an established rock guitarist, and Moon, who's the girl, is a pseudo-actress and singer. They've both served as guest VJs on MTV, which they did with attitude, acting smugly superior to everything around them. Well, they can't pull that off anymore, not as stars of a fairly standard, make that below standard, TV sitcom. Instead of having the leader of the Mothers of Invention as a father, Dweezil and Moon Unit now have Cindy Williams of Laverne and Shirley as a mother, and Max Gale of Barney Miller as a father, and such standard sitcom trappings as a ditzy friend, a funny next-door neighbor, and a cute but confused little brother. Instead of being a rock star, Dweezil's character wants to be a rock star. And when he gives his little brother advice on being his own man, Dweezil uses his guitar as a visual and musical aid.
Is that Van Halen?
No, that's me. See, it's similar, but it's not exactly the same. You know, I can learn one of Edward's solos note for note. And believe me, I do. But when I write, I let him inspire me to be the best that I can be in my own style.
Dweezil gives this show its only energy. He easily eclipses his sister Moon, but if the scripts don't get better and hipper, even Dweezil will come off looking like a dweeb. Sydney is the better of the two new shows. The title star is Valerie Bertinelli, who played the cute daughter in One Day at a Time, and in real life is the wife of the aforementioned Eddie Van Halen. In Sydney, she's a private eye, and she's single, especially after she breaks up with her boyfriend, played by guest star Tom Bird.
I'm sorry, Sid. It's just that I'm going to miss you.
Oh, geez, Rick, you're a crier, too?
Uh-huh.
The private eye premise of this sitcom gives Bertinelli the chance to go undercover, play different roles, and interact with a support group that includes, let's see now, a ditzy boss, a funny next-door neighbor, and a cute but confused big brother. The series aims for a screwball comedy style, with Bertinelli acting and talking like a female David Addison. She's pretty good at it, and she's surrounded by a good supporting cast, especially Craig Burko, who plays her eventual boss. Here's how her job interview starts out.
Hi, I'm Sydney Kells. Billy's sister, we had a meeting.
You? You're a private eye?
Yes, I am.
Well, Billy never said he had a sister.
He didn't?
No, he said he had a Sydney, a friend who was a PI, but he never said that it was a girl, a woman, a female type lady.
Sydney is no groundbreaker, but it plays the conventions well, and it's Bertinelli's best showcase in quite a while. It's also CBS's first solid sitcom pilot in 6 months, so the network ought to stick with it. As for normal life, it needs work. Pretty soon, I suspect, so will Dweezil and Moon Unit.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert Caro tells us about the latest volume in his biography of Lyndon Johnson. It offers proof that Johnson stole the 1948 senatorial election. Also, Soviet emigre artists Komar and Melamed talk about the lack of freedom in the Soviet Union and the New York art scene. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for Fresh Air.